Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
You are back in the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. And today, sitting in sidelines, we got the game. We got
Mr. That's right. Brian emphasis Turner. On the game. Game. Yes. It's Brian. And hello. Nice to be back.
It's the game. Yeah. You've been gone for a long time.
I know. Too long. Don't take it personal. All right. Well, actually, you can take it personal. It was mainly you anyway. So.
Well, of course. I always upset people. I forgot who you were. I mean,
that's why you're like, who's the game again?
Oh, yeah. Who's the game? The game. Well, So what's going on? So now you are back. And in the crack, and everything's good.
Yeah, that's definitely how you think about it, for sure.
How's the Mind's Eye podcast going?
Mind's Eye's it's on a little break right now because I am writing a book, not a little different from our guest tonight, Garrick. I'm focusing on that, and I'm almost done. So I really wanted to put all my effort. I can't do like a million projects like you, Alan. I just don't have that skill level and that focus. So I got to focus one at a time.
That's because I'm all alone and I have nobody to love me. That's why
I didn't want to say it, but I'm glad you did.
Well, so you're rewriting different than Derek. You're writing instead about the Turkish pretender. You're writing about the Turkish bash.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And I really go into the history of it. I'm sure Gary can talk a little bit more about the Turkish bath than I can, but I like to learn from all, for sure.
Of course, you're a watcher. Oh, you know, voyeur, I think they called you. That's why the voyeur game.
Only with these two gentlemen right here, for sure.
Yeah, well, general, there you go. You obviously don't know our guest. So our guest is the returning, and he's known as the gentle Garrick Jones. Thanks for being here, Garrick.
My pleasure. Nice to be back again. G'day, fellas.
G'day, yeah. Hello. So what's going on? How's Garrick been the last little while, like all this stuff?
Today's been the first sort of real lull in my life for months. I somehow managed with editors changing around deadlines and publishers, ended up sort of juggling four books at once. And one of them's just released last week, so I've just got a bit of a breathing space now. But it's been very, very busy. I really don't like multitasking that much. But yeah, apart from that, the COVID situation where I live in the small coastal town on the Great Barrier Reef hasn't really affected us much. We've only had 1 week of compulsory mask wearing in the past 2 years. And I'm fully jabbed. and so life goes on.
Well, you were fully jabbed before the...
Not for a number of years, Alan.
Especially when you two get it together, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, so I always wonder about this with writers, because it takes so much of you in the book, especially when you're adding a lot of yourself to it, like in fictional stories as well as historical, and you're putting it together. So none of this sort of has bothered you the last year or so, and now with Russia and everything going on.
Exactly. Incredibly, that this latest book that's just come out, The Servants of the Crown, The Turkish Pretender, is based in 1855 in London at the end of the Crimean War. And it's about, it has lots to do with Russians and the Crimea, timely. And there's mention of Ukraine in it as well. And of course, I wrote this book 5 years ago, so there was a bit of prescience there. It's been on my mind when I was checking the final proof, which was just about the time that the first invasion started. It resonated quite a bit.
Yeah, it's something that never, I don't know, it just never ends, does it? You know, it's something you're writing about that happened so long ago is still really happening now.
Yeah, and of course, then everybody says, "Oh, you're riding the wave of a popular thing," and you have to try to explain. Well, no, this was written. Book was written in 2017. You know, not yesterday. Books don't write themselves unless you're incredibly prolific in a matter of weeks. I mean, my books usually take about 3 months for the first draft, and probably about a year after I've written the first draft before they say get to the publisher. You know.
Yeah. Well, if you were riding the wave, you'd throw a pandemic in there.
Oh, exactly. And I'm a bit sick of pandemic books, to be honest. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Loving the pandemic. I'm going to barf if I hear one more.
Yeah.
Read one more book about that.
Yeah, I can't.
It's interesting. I just picked up a book I hadn't read for years and years. There used to be a Men on Men series, which was a whole collection of short stories. I don't remember it, published in the 80s and 90s. And I was just reading Men on Men 3, and it was all about the AIDS crisis. And, of course, we don't really think about that anymore. But every book written by gay people and about gay people was about death in that period.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the same now. But the thing is, it's crazy now, because every time I go to put on Netflix or something like that, or streaming, you know, you go through 10 or 20 movies and it's some sort of end of the world pandemic, virus, disease, or zombie. Yeah. And I'm thinking, well, it's, you know.
Asteroids, that's the other one, crashing into Earth.
It's all the end. Gloom and doom, you know.
Yep.
What brought you to write this book?
This is a really interesting story, and I hope it doesn't get too boring. But when my first book was published with Manifold Press in the UK, I got to meet a whole lot of interesting young UK writers and older UK writers. And I was introduced to one particular writer who was very, very interesting. We spent a lot of time chatting in a forum, and he was a young disabled man and just getting into writing, and asked me if I'd be interested in co-writing a book as an exercise. I said, sure, you're. And we wrote this book, which was called Undercurrents in those days. And I sent the book to the publisher, and who was not real happy with it, said it just sounded like, read like two different people writing separately. And I quite agreed. But just at that point, it was discovered that this particular young man had been catfishing us, including the publisher, and wasn't actually a young disabled man in a wheelchair, but an older woman in her 60s in a wheelchair pretending to be a man.
Alan can obviously relate to that, but, you know.
Oh, my God. Well, it was a huge shock because, you know, in the course of the conversation over the year that we've been writing it, there was all sorts of, like, quite intimate exchanges. This wasn't sexual, but talking about very private things and experiences. And I suddenly realized, you know, I'd been pulled into this conversation in some sort of vicarious enjoyment by this older woman pretending to be a young man. I never was interested in flirting or anything like that, but just disclosing personal details because, you know, this young guy said he'd never had any sexual experiences and wanted to know what X was like. And X, so it was really, really creepy. So eventually the publisher got the rights back and I retained the rights to the whole book and stuck it away in a cupboard and ignored at me because I really found the subject and the period interesting. So last year I decided to rewrite the whole thing in my own words. I changed all the characters. I kept the basic plot the same. And then when I submitted to the publisher, they absolutely loved it. So that just came out last week. But it was a very rough time. It left me feeling really dirty for a long time afterwards.
That's a lot to chew on that right there. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
And I want to come back to the book in a little bit, but just because it's such like a crazy story. You never had any indication that
never,
you, never at all. Yeah. Wow. Huh.
The only indication I ever had was that we were talking about the Napoleonic Wars, and I asked in an email, as you do, I asked in an email, you know, whether he'd ever seen the Hornblower series with Ioan Griffith, and said no. And I said, well, I'd love to send you a copy for Christmas. And he said, oh, we haven't got a post box. We live miles away from the post office and everything. So I sent it to a friend, and I should have twigged then that there was something wrong going on.
And how did you get reached out to by this person? Just because it's just like it's so wild to me. How did you connect?
It was in this chat room. We're talking about writing, and this young guy was saying he was just starting out and just wanted an exercise. I thought it would be a really good exercise for me, seeing how other people write, because I was relatively new to writing myself, and I just wanted to see how another author's mind thought. But I really liked the story. And although I didn't always agree with what he wrote, I thought, well, you know, let's see what the publisher thinks. And of course, I didn't like it.
And it's funny because you still refer to that person as him, but you, knowing it's a woman, whatever happened to this person?
I have no idea, but they were ostracized from the writer community. It was one of those big scandals. Do you remember Josh Lanyon, the big scandal with Josh Lanyon? Who writes a lot of crime novels, and actually, you know, catfished the whole writing community by saying read books written by a man about men, and actually turned out to be a woman, you know. And is still writing and as a woman and has been accepted by the gay romance community, which is mostly women readers anyway. But
wow.
Yeah, that's their story. I mean, they write really well, but that whole idea of pretending to be something that you aren't doesn't sit well on my shoulders.
No. That's
and you can usually pretty well tell if there's a sex scene. Once you start reading, you go, no, guys, don't do that. I mean, we do a lot.
How dare you?
But we don't do that.
But we don't do that.
It was way too tender.
I wrote to one woman. I said, you might have to edit this out. I said, just, you know, when you go home, just ask your husband to stick it in your in the ironing with no preparation and see how you think it feels. Anyway, so that was this experience of writing. It was pretty cathartic at the time because I thought to myself, geez, I must be really getting old to being hoodwinked for such a long, long time. But the writing was so... it was so engaging in a way that made me feel really sorry for this person who I thought was a young guy in a wheelchair. Mm. You know, when I rewrote it, it was a cleansing process. I think I wrote a much, much better story. It was all in my own voice, of course, which makes the book cohesive, makes it coherent from the beginning to end. So it doesn't feel like a whole lot of chopped up dialogues written by a committee.
Right. Right. All right. So let's tell the listeners, what is the basic premise of the book?
The basic premise of the book is a rumor that was going around during Queen Victoria's reign that her father had entered into a morganatic marriage. That means a marriage of a noble person with a base-born person, and had fathered a son. And then when his father, George III, had found out, dissolved the marriage, and the child had been spirited away. So the premise behind this story is this clique of disaffected English noblemen and Irishmen who were really unhappy with a woman on the throne, and Queen Victoria's husband was very, very unpopular in the 1850s. And they hatched this plot to bring this child, the pretender, who'd been brought up in Turkey, and overthrow the throne and install him as the king, as a puppet king. Because the way they brought him up was without him learning English, only being able to speak in French and Russian, and they were going to rule through him. So that's the premise of the story. But it's actually about a group of four young men called the Brothers who grew up together, and two of whom grew up together, and the other two who they met in their teenage years, who've been friends for 20 years, and who two of them work for the Foreign Secretary as what I call intelligencers, which is a Victorian equivalent of spies. And this group of the four are tasked with uncovering the plot, finding out who's behind it, and stopping the pretender from arriving in London so that the plot to overthrow Queen Victoria can be foiled.
When you put this together, how do you decide what you're going to do with the story? Like there's truths, there's history, and then there's fiction. How do you draw that line?
It all has to be based on historical accuracy. That's the way that I write. When I write, I probably, the majority of my time is researching before I put a word on the page. So I did a lot of research on London in the 1850s, the hospital system, what people did, a lot of research into the aristocracy and the use of titles and deference and who went where, who was living where, what sort of jobs were available. And because it revolves around a major British shipping line, a lot of research into goods and traffic by clipper and early steamboat. So once I got that all worked out and I had all the facts in place, then I was able to slot the story into around those historical facts. Because there's nothing worse than reading something where you go, oh, no, that couldn't have possibly happened because on that date, Fred Bloggs was in, I don't know, wherever.
Yeah. When you get all the facts together and you've got it all laid out, kind of the basically what's going on, how do you decide where you're going to bring the story to or what you're going to tell in the story?
Well, I always have an idea of what the plot is before I start. And I'm a pantser. You know what that means?
Oh, yeah. By the seat of the pants.
Yeah, I'm a pantser. So I always have a beginning in my mind, I have an end in my mind, and I have the denouement or the big action crisis scene in my mind before I start. So it's that somehow, as I'm writing, it always leads me to those points and where I place the action and where I place the human interest or where I slot little bits of history into the dialogue without it being an information dump. It's sort of a reasonably natural process for me.
Yeah.
Although I wouldn't say it's easy.
No, it wouldn't be. And I never wear pants myself, so I'm not a pantser. He's a deep pantser, yeah. No,
I live in tropical Queensland, and you can imagine what life's like up here.
Oh, God, yeah, you know.
That's why I asked if we were doing video.
Yeah. Well, there we go. I missed my chance.
We can switch over. We can easily switch over.
And get the TV going. Yeah. You know, mystery TV, we'll watch it.
Yeah.
Well, I always find it interesting that you put together a story and it's centered on the truth. But when you say human interest, so do you have something you want to get across to people, like subtext?
Always, yeah. Always. The subtext with all of my books, and this is the ninth one I've had published. I'm a very, very lucky writer. My basic ideal in all of my books is to demonstrate that gay men are not a race apart. We just are like any other man in the world. The only difference is that we might go home to a partner of the same sex. We can be bricklayers, we can be judges, we can be labourers, we can be whatever you want to call it. And we don't define ourselves by sexuality, most of us. We just happen to be gay. And that's what I try to put in my books, the normality of most of the gay men's lives in the world. And I translate that historically as well, as I'm writing.
How do you feel like the modern day gay community finds that? Because everybody's so into identifying themselves as,
I know,
and labeling, yeah, and stuff. Like, I, you know, 'cause I'm like in your age category, and I'm always sort of, you know, I always wonder why everyone's so.
Well, I suppose in being brought up in the, you know, I grew up in the 1950s, where that was a period where people knew other people were gay, but you never actually talked about it. In fact, no one ever talked about their personal life because it was considered bad manners. You know, you didn't, if you started talking about somebody's personal life, you were branded a gossip and people would not like you much. So also gay men during that in the 1950s and the early 1960s, we learned to compartmentalize our lives, living double identities, if you like. And it was no great hardship. I suppose modern people think it is some sort of like, oh my God, it must have been terrible walking around with your collar pulled up and your hat over your eyes so nobody recognized you. It wasn't like that. You just learned to behave in different ways, like speaking two languages. You know, you speak English at home, you speak Italian out in the community if you live in Italy. It's just part of the way that we're brought up. But this whole identity of the gay community, somebody once said to me, we just had the Mardi Gras here, the Sydney Mardi Gras, and somebody once said to me, for every single guy on one of those floats, and there must be thousands of them, there's 20 or 30 other guys out there living in the community who don't actually think about, don't identify themselves with the gay community. It's just their sexuality that differs. And I think we need to keep that in mind, that the visible gay community is really the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people in society, to him, it's no great thing. The fact that they happen to love another man or they happen to like sleeping with other guys, the same with women as well. If they have a partner or they like sleeping with somebody of the same sex, it doesn't define who they are. It's just, you know, part of their lives. So that's what I try to do in every book I've written, is just to describe that normality of life of people who don't necessarily identify as within the community, in inverted commas.
How do you tackle that? Like, how do you do that with, without trying to emphasize on the gay parts of the people, but yet let them know they're gay? Like, what?
You just, well, if you read any detective novel written by anybody in the whole of history, you write it exactly the same, except that the protagonist might have a boyfriend. In my Clyde Smith mystery series, which you've already interviewed me about. Clyde's just an ex-war veteran. He's been a cop and now he's working as a private detective. He has connections through his close circle of friends who are gay men, to, you know, what gay life's like. But there's, at those days in the 1950s, there weren't gay clubs. There weren't, not in Australia. I know there were gay bars and stuff in the US, and we didn't have bathhouses in the same way that you did in the States all the way through. We had Turkish baths, but that was completely sort of different thing, and they were never pick-up places. So he just goes about his life, and it's just like a regular detective crime fiction book, except he's got a boyfriend.
Right, right. Well, you know, I think that... when you read Brian's book, you'll realize that there was a pickup joint in the Turkish
bank. Yes, yes, we did. We went over this. Yeah, you know, that's how I inject my life into my own book personally. What about you? I mean, how do you inject, like, you know, outside of, you know, getting through this idea, you know, the normality of being gay and putting that into your books, how do you inject your own personal life into it outside of that aspect?
In many, many ways. There's I wrote a series, my first book published was a book called The Boys of Boolaroo, which is a collection of six short stories spanning six decades in the 20th century. And each one of them is about different aspects of men at war or in between the wars and forming friendships and meeting other guys and falling in love. And nearly every one of those six stories has something autobiographical in it. In fact, the last story in it is basically the story of me meeting the great love of my life, who was an American soldier on R&R in 1966 on the beach in Sydney. So, but I put that in the story. I think it's really, you know, I've had a very interesting life. I had 30 years as a professional opera singer all over the world. I when I left that, I went into lecturing in university and history. So I've had a lot of experiences that I try to bleed those into my stories to give it some sense of reality and grounding so that it's not all just fiction, but there's some truth behind. See, for example, I never write about any place that I've never lived in or visited for any, where I spend any amount of time in. I just don't think that that's right.
Yeah, there's definitely a feel. There's something you pick up when you go to these places.
Oh, for sure. You've only got to go in any country in the world and have a look what the regular cup of coffee is. And, I mean, it's not the same in any country in the whole wide world. You just realize that every culture has something completely different to it.
So when I read some of your books and I see the gay opera singer turned writer, that is like a – it's pretty obvious that is you, not just a character then.
Yeah.
We can expect that one.
Yeah, please. I did one of my really popular books is a book, it's a theatre murder mystery set in 1902, in which I talk about, during the crime investigation, I talk about what it's like to be a performer and what it's like backstage, what it's like to be in the dressing room, what it's like when you're putting your makeup on or trying your costumes on, what it's like to rehearse, what it's like standing backstage and watching all the scenery move. And people found that really, really fascinating because there's not much out there about that. And also having a gay protagonist and a murder mystery, it's been very, very popular, that book.
He's made plenty of men sing. There's lots of
reverse the role. I like
it.
All over YouTube. He's got them all screaming at the top of their lungs. It's like,
Yeah, this, interestingly enough, this is slightly tangential. In the course of writing, I've worked with four really, really, really amazing editors. I was having a discussion this morning with my new editor in the UK, Nick Taylor, about how not necessarily finding an editor, but finding the editor for you is so important, because when you actually write a book, you need somebody who needs to get what you're about and not try to make it their version of your book. So that's been a really interesting process all the way along. I've been so fortunate to have had four amazing editors, two of whom I still work with. Nick, who's going to be editing my next Clyde Smith book, which goes to him tomorrow to come out in October, and Linda McQueen, who's the editor for Yale University Press in London, who edits my World War II series. It's just reassuring to get that... what do you call it? So like an iron fist in a velvet glove treatment. That really pushes any writer on to feel validated in their craft.
So you must be fascinated with the history and stuff. What's your favorite era, like 1900s?
My favorite era, I suppose, is the 1950s, because that's the era in which I grew up, surrounded by a whole lot of men who were basically what I call ruined men, who came back from the war and put on smiles and tried to be happy, but were like just traumatized inside. My whole life was, as a young man, was brought about these guys who would get in, start punching each other up the moment had a couple of beers to try and, get rid of the violence. And I'm really fascinated by that era of the new world where everything old was thrown out. We're going to have a complete new society after the Second World War. The whole thing staffed, if you want to say the word, or led by these ruined guys who just had all of this.
How dare you!
Side that they were told to just smile and get on with life, get married, no matter what you did. I've just finished reading for the third time Berube's book, Coming Out Under Fire, which is his book about the American military and gay people during the Second World War. And that whole thing of all these guys coming back and just getting married because they had to when they're basically gay. I'm fascinated by that period, because I didn't understand it as a kid, but as I got older.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Alderaan understood, you know, what these guys were going through.
Now, and do you think like the pendulum has swung to the opposite way? And you know, with the generational difference, you know, they had to get married, and now obviously people are more open. I mean, what type of impact do you think that?
I think there's still a lot of that going on. I've got a friend who 5 years ago, after 40 years of marriage, decided when the kids left home, you know, and grandchildren and stuff, suddenly decided he'd been gay his whole life and left his wife. And I think, well, why the hell? And he said to me, I got married because that was what was expected of me. It still goes on. You still get guys. I mean, I did a lot of, Alan and I were talking about this when we were talking about my book Wheelchair, when I did a lot of research with vets and cops and stuff like that about what do you call it? Beats? Is that the word? Places where men pick each other up.
Oh, yeah.
Alan would know that. You know.
Cruising places, right. So, and he said, one of the guys said to me, most of the guys that he meets in these parks and places are all married guys. So there's still a lot going on. I don't think a lot of that's progressed. I think the awareness of gay people has moved on a lot, and generally society's been accepting, but I think a lot of men still struggle with the notions of what it is to be a man, with the notions of masculinity.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's a lot of men that live the, let's say, the standard lifestyle, the you know, married and kids and that, but they, it's part of who they believe they should be.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who's been in the military and will be really, really super honest will, especially, I don't know about these days, but people in places of war or conflict or something will tell you that there are moments when they have been tempted if or not have given in.
Do you think that shame that, you know, I guess, you know, even though it's still there in depending on the part of your world, but do you think that shame that was given to gay men, you know, gay people, has now been transferred to those who identify as trans and are trans?
Look, I think we have a circle of hate. Every decade there's somebody new to hate. There's a whole lot of, you know.
As a Jewish man, I get it. Trust me.
Yeah. what's the worst thing about society? Somebody asks a question, and my answer is enforced religion. I mean, people should be be free to choose what they worship and not to proselytize and not to judge other people. What goes on in the USA? I mean, we sit here and shake our heads so often about, you know, stuff that goes in the name of so-called Christianity, which has actually got nothing to do with Christianity at all. It's about, I don't know what it's about, giving people an opportunity to hate other people. And I suppose it goes for all religions. I shouldn't just pick on Christians. But, you know, we see hate everywhere. And it's cyclical. It moves from one subject to another. After trans people, it'll probably revolve to, I don't know, what's left.
Yeah, it just goes back and forth. We'll go back to the Jews.
you know, hope
we're not. Always there. Don't worry. That's, we're always part of one big time for sure.
I mean, why define a person by what they do and not by who they are? Mm-hmm. That's also something that I try to write about, that people get attracted to other people by who they are, not by what they look like, not by what they do. You know, it's what we fall in love with people properly. You know, it's because of who the people are. Otherwise you wouldn't get, you know, you go see some really, really amazingly good looking guy with a really maybe not so glamorous looking woman, but they get together not because of the way each other looks, but because of the way that they feel about each other, who that person is. There should be a lot more of that in this world. We should get rid of reality TV, put the Kardashians in the wood chipper and mm-hmm. start to talk about, you know, real people.
I couldn't say it better myself.
Well, you know, chipper. Yeah. We Aussies, we say it as it is.
Is that because of the history there? Because you guys, you know, modern era post-Aborigine, you know, because obviously I think most people are familiar that it established as a penal colony. Do you think that's what that stems from?
Most certainly. But we have a thing called, I'm not sure if you know about it, but you need to probably read up. It's called the tall poppy syndrome, which means we don't like people who stick their heads up above everybody else. For example, it's really considered bad luck to – not bad luck. It's considered really downclassed to blow your own trumpet. So that whole thing of flaunting money and getting people to judge you by your wealth or your standing doesn't sit well with us. So we really like to take the piss out of people. Our Prime Minister's getting so much rubbish at the moment, quite publicly, you know, called the liar in public and stuff like that. That would probably not happen in many other countries in the world. But we do.
For what, though? What is he getting called out for specifically?
Oh, don't start me.
I just read the engine, man. I just let you go. You know?
Well, if you have a look at I don't know if you know, we did a huge $100 billion deal with the French for submarines, which the Australian government cancelled. And Macron, when he was asked, he said we didn't get any notice. And he said, do you think the Australian Prime Minister lied to you? And he said, I don't think. I know he did. And so that's now – that's one of the things. And plus – he does love to tell lies, our Prime Minister, and he's caught out on so many of them. And even when he's confronted with the truth, he still disavows it.
Yeah.
Sounds like a politician to me.
Well, it's a right-wing politician, you know. We have this fashion all over the world of our Prime Minister. You had Trump, Boris Johnson, Bolsonaro, the guy in Belarus, whose name I can't think of. Yeah. You know, these dictators all over the world who just, blurt out untruths, and they get away with it.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy how you can get away with it. You know, it makes no sense. You take the characters in this book, like in The Servants of the Crown, for instance. How do you develop them when they're already dead? Like this is a long time ago. How do you fill in the blanks? Like, what's your method?
Well, I do a lot of research about domestic life in the period that I'm writing in. So, for example, if you look at, do you know about Mrs. Beaton's cookbook? You must have heard of that.
Yeah.
Yep. For example, she has a huge section about how the lady of the house should act, what the maid does, what the valet does, what the footman do, you know, what the scullery maid does. So just reading through that in a cookbook gives you a pretty good idea of how an aristocratic household works. And then you'd read a lot of literature of the period about the relationships between the aristocracy, the middle class, and the working class. And then you start to formulate what this person might be expected to do, which gives you a pretty good idea of the way they're going to travel through the book. In this particular book, the main character is the elder son of a third son, and he isn't expected to inherit anything, and by total misfortune inherits a baronetcy when he's not prepared for it and has to take over a huge global shipping company and a title and huge houses, and he really doesn't want it. So it's not a book about, oh, this is great, isn't this fantastic, we'll make this guy into a bright, shining star. It's about his journey of struggling with moving into a different class of society and not wanting it.
Yeah, you know, I always find that to be the most interesting. How do you think it's when you, now that you've published the book, how do you think it's changed you?
It's actually taken a huge weight off my shoulders because, as I told you before, I can't tell you how much that awful episode affected me. I mean, I'm a pretty grown-up man. I've been on the earth a long time. I hate being taken for a ride, and I really, really was. So writing that book actually sort of cleansed that whole episode out of my life. It also gave me a lot of satisfaction of writing in a style that I don't normally write in. It's sort of like semi-Dickensian style, using the language and the form of syntax and vocabulary that was used in the 1850s. And to try to form really relationships as they might have been through the norms of society, what was expected in society. And that was a real, and also discovering what it was like to be a gay man during that period. There's quite a lot of literature come out about that recently, including a whole book about Victorians and their servants and sexuality. So, you know, that research just made me feel good. I love researching. So that was like a tick in the box for me, having done that.
You know, one thing that I find curious about that time, now this is long before gays were even legal. You know, there was the mindset that being homosexual, you were probably sick mentally and you needed help, or you should just be put away in jail and, you know, you're something bad, no matter what point of view it was. So with that being in the world that you live in, did they ever have the concept or the idea of having a relationship with another man? Not just
of course
sex.
They did.
What I'm trying to get at is how would they see it in their mind?
They basically wouldn't talk about it for a start in sort of aristocratic circles. And even in aristocratic circles, if they knew somebody was gay or queer or anything, they just like accepted it as long as they behave properly. They might tut-tut, you know, to their spouse, but they would never, ever talk about it. And people, I mean, this is a period where men had two or three mistresses, remember? They got married for money, for dowries, or they, you know, the whole concept of marrying for love was not a great thing then. It might have been written about in Jane Austen's book, but it was an expectation of marrying within your class to further the line. And most people got married to somebody they never knew, really knew. And they had, men had mistresses. They went to brothels. They went to Molly houses, which was a gay brothel. There were millions of those around. So it was really well understood. And in the working classes and the poor classes, of course, it was just like it was during the Depression for a lot of men. A lot of straight married men who didn't have any money went out and stood on the curb and waited for some guy to come and pick them up and give them a blow.
Oh, my.
Job in their car. That's where our concept of the masculine gay man comes from. That is that period of the Depression from America where all of a sudden so-called straight men started, you know, being available for sex, for money. But, you know, the same thing happened in Victorian England. There's all sorts of scandals about gay bordellos where members of the aristocracy were caught. And, of course, quite famous long-standing relationships between earls and dukes with their valet, who was their personal manservant. It was the way that they managed to continue to keep a thriving relationship going, was having a close personal servant, where they couldn't have with another member of the aristocracy, for example.
Who's the most famous person of that era we know now as gay? You know,
I knew you were going to ask me that, but I'll have to look it up. There's actually a book called Victorian Their Servants and Sexuality. It's in the other room. I could go and drag it out if you like. But there is quite a famous, I think he was an earl, and his relationship with his valet was very, very long, you know, right throughout their lives, and everybody knew about it.
But they wouldn't, in their mind, they wouldn't be thinking like marriage.
No, I think that they probably would have liked to. No, I think they probably would have liked to. You see, up until what a lot of people don't, I can't see this book. I'm sitting right near my bookcase. There's a book about same-sex relationships within the church. And here it is. It's called The Marriage of Likeness by John Boswell. It's a very, very good, interesting book, and it's subtitled Same-Sex Unions in Pre-Modern Europe. And in that book, you'll read about a whole lot of religious ceremonies that were performed right up until the 14th century, solemnizing relationships between men. That's something that people don't realize, that, you know, the church was, you know, giving blessings to gay marriages up until the 13th and 14th centuries. Hmm. So, you know, where did it change? I mean, we look back at ancient Greek, ancient Roman societies where, you know, men slept with their slaves, their male slaves, and they had relationships with each other. Where did it all change? And I hate to say it's this prevalence of sort of puritanical Christian ethic. I can't comment on Judaism or Islam because I don't know much about that. But if it's based on Old Testament stuff, then I probably will think it's pretty frowned upon. I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. For some reason, yeah, that's, yeah. You know.
I mean, is there any actual place in the Bible where it's, that, where it's like anti-gay? Like, you know, I haven't read the New Testament, you know, or anything like that.
Not in the Old Testament. In the New Testament is, but we have, to my mind, and this is probably going to create a whole lot of hate mail, but mm-hmm. there was a Council of Nicaea, I think it was 430 something or other, 400 years after the death of Christ, where a whole lot of church people got together and they decided what was going to be in the Bible.
Right.
So the Bible was written by a whole lot of blokes 400 years after mm-hmm. Jesus lived. And there were certain books from the Bible cut because they didn't fit in with male patriarchal ideas. There's a book of Mary Magdalene, for example. So women didn't get a look in. And who knows? I don't know if there were any first, like, documents of the letters of St. Paul. I don't think we have a document actually written in his handwriting. And he's the one who talks about you know, men laying together in abominations. I may be wrong. I may have got that all muddled up, but still goes on. I mean, if you're a farmer, go out into any field and you see cows jumping on each other and bulls jumping on each other and stuff. It's part of nature, homosexuality. It's not a learned thing. It's a genetic thing. That's my two cents worth.
I'm all excited here. So now, let's talk about people getting a hold of you. And all the hate mail goes to you. So how is it people contact you?
Through my website, which is just garrickjones.com.au. And there's a on my website, there's a link of how you can get in touch with me, write emails to me. I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter as well. Where else? Oh, well.
Grindr?
No. I saw a wonderful mug the other day, which had on it, I met your dad on Grindr. And I was wondering, if I could buy, who do I know I could buy that and send that to?
Boy, you have to be careful there.
Well, if you do get some hate mail, I've learned that if as many people hate you as they do love you, you're probably actually doing something right instead of something wrong.
Yeah, I don't know. I the worst review I've had two. I'm very, very, very lucky again, not only getting published so much, but having really, really good reviews. The two worst reviews I've ever had was somebody who bought The Boys of Bullaroo, which is all about the war and guys fighting together, who gave it one star and said, "This book is full of homosexuals." I felt like saying, "Read the blurb, you idiot." And the other one was about a woman who wrote a short story that was published by Manifold Press. It was actually set in Canada, and it's called "Oh Canada," the story. And she wrote and she said, "I didn't like this story. It's too male."
Wow. Then you write, "I didn't like this reviewer. It's too female."
You go, what goes through these people's minds? What do they do? They look at the picture and go, "Oh, I'll buy that book because it's got a pretty cover." That is my idea, is the very, very worst reason for buying a book. You know, the reason for buying a book is what's between the front cover and the back cover.
Well.
And you can, and a good cover helps, but, you know, if you buy a book and people can't string three words together, what's going to make you buy another book by that writer?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's a reason why they don't put Alan on picture on the books.
Yeah. For that unless exactly. They powder my forehead.
I liked your new picture, Alan. I thought it was really good.
Oh.
Really nice.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. I don't know what Brian looks at, but I'll go and stalk him in a minute.
Well,
Yeah, I don't want you obsessing over me. Come
yeah,
on,
he's the young, good-looking man. You know, he has no.
I have one patch of hair left, so I'm technically, I guess maybe a little bit. Yeah.
The game.
Yes.
So up and coming stuff. Can I talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was going to say. What's coming next?
Yeah, so the third Clyde Smith's detective stories, which is set in 1957. In Sydney, goes to the editor on this Saturday, and so that should hit the shelves in October. And then the third book in my World War II stories goes to the other editor in August, and that'll be out early next year. And I have a short story in an anthology of gay mysteries based on holidays and July, which will come out in the middle of the year. And of course, me being me, I wrote to the editor and I said, we don't have any holidays in Australia in July. He said, I'll write about something that's really, that you could twist about. So what did I do? I wrote a story set in 1947 about a young man who is given a forced in holiday from work because he's having a bit of a nervous breakdown after the war and told to go on a holiday. So he goes to Darwin to discover what happens to his best mate who was presumably killed during the bombing of Darwin in 1942 and then discovers this big murder mystery in it. So everybody's really, really loved that, who did the beta reading and the editors and the publishers. So that'll be coming out in the middle of the year.
Wow.
With including such well-known authors as Michael Narva, people like that, Frank Butterfield, Brad Shreve, I'll be very happy to be part of that collection.
Wow.
And mind you, that book took me, that short story, 18,000 words, took me about 3 months of research to get right because a lot of the material is still classified. People don't realize that the bombing of Darwin, there were more planes, more bombs, more ships sunk than Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that. It was the largest bombing attack on any city at the time in 1942 in the world, and that included Coventry in Britain.
Yeah. 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 I just saw a little documentary show on that actually, probably a month ago. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Well, it was the anniversary of it. I think it must've been the 70th anniversary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or 80th anniversary, 2022. Yeah.
That's so, why you're a writer, not a mathematician.
Fascinating part of history. So, and I've also visited Darwin quite a lot. I have a good pal who lives there, and he did a beta read for me just to make sure I get all the places right and all of the how long it took to travel. But I think it's a really good murder mystery. It's also the first erotic book I've written with eroticism, and I've written in 6 years. So that was actually quite fun to write. I'd forgotten how much I like writing nitty-gritty scenes.
So how did
although they're not like other people's nitty-gritty scenes. It's all comparative.
Yeah, of course, right. But so when you're doing that, do you have to get in practice and get someone over and sort of work it out, the details?
No, my memory isn't that bad.
Well, you know, you might want to try some new things or see if certain things could work. And I don't know. I'm just trying to help out.
He's volunteering, is what he's saying.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just trying to help out. I'm there. I'm the writers. I'm the help for the writers. I'm the helping hand.
You're the muse, for sure.
And look, can I give a general warning to perhaps female writers who write gay fiction, and there's a lot about, don't base what we do by watching porn. Please
don't base anything. It doesn't have to be gay. Just anything.
Oh God.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. I hear a lot of things like that.
Now get an editor. Ask your best gay friend to read it and go, you know, is this possible? Is it possible to do this X thing on the first date? The answer is pretty usually no.
Yeah. But you have to wonder what because I hear. A lot of the male books like that have female readers as the primary
Well, it is the male-to-male romance category is basically all women, a few men, but writing for other women. So that's the way that's evolved.
Yeah, yeah. So for me, it doesn't interest me. But now,
So I think some of the stories I've read are really, really good, but they're not the ones that have a lot of sex scenes in them, because that's usually where it falls down. And look, honestly, you know yourself, men relate to each other in a completely different way than men and women relate to each other. I tried to explain it to somebody once. It's like pieces of a jigsaw. You have the indentation and then the bit that sticks out that fit together. That's male female thing. But when you've got two bits that stick out together or two indentations that bump up together, there's a lot more negotiation, because men, we're not brought up with expectations of how we're supposed to behave in relationships the way that men and women are, that the women do have the babies, maybe do the most of the housework, and the guys, go out to work and stuff. You've got two guys having to always continually work out who does what, negotiating about the relationships. Because if there are two men, we have testosterone. So there's all those other sorts of things that have to be negotiated. So I think that's the big difference about really writing about male to male and male relationships.
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
I don't know if you agree, but I mean, that's my feeling.
I think for the most part I do, but again, a younger generation might see things differently.
Well, I think that probably is the case. I mean, people my age, I'm in my early 70s now. When I was brought up, there were very defined roles, that I remember having to be guarantor when my mother wanted to buy a car, and I was only 18.
Right.
Because she wasn't able to take out a loan.
Yeah.
She couldn't get a passport without her divorced husband allowing her to get a passport. Life was very different for women back then. And when you're brought up, with the sort of mores that were in your family. So you get a whole lot of ideas about defined roles, and they're very, very hard to shake off. Very hard to shake off. Us older people fighting them all the time. I still open the doors for women. I still walk on the right-hand side when we're walking in the street. If I'm walking with a woman, I still say thank you. I still send thank you cards to people. I write little letters, if they've invited me to dinner, thanking them. It's a generational thing.
Wow.
I don't know. Do you open doors for women if you with them?
No, I close them.
What an uncouth man.
I do. I was brought up that way too, so I have a lot of those habits myself. But I don't see that with the younger generation. I don't see that as a standard.
I don't mix with the – I don't have any younger generational friends anymore. I mean, my family's all now dead, and the closest I have is cousins. I suppose they're in their teens who live in Chicago, who I've never actually ever met. So I don't get to see, when I was lecturing at university, I didn't get to see much of their social life. I just saw them as students, and we had, that sort of relationship, but I didn't get to see how they interact with each other without me around. So I don't really know what they do.
Oh, they just slap each other at the Oscars.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons, that's one of the reasons I don't write contemporary books, because I have no idea about what's going on.
Well, that could be an idea for a new series. You could be brought back into the future.
I could write about a grumpy old man trying to negotiate his way through modern society. That would plenty of experience with that.
Yeah.
I went to a shop recently, a big department store, and I wanted to buy something, and it was $17.50. And I gave the girl $22.50, and she pulled out a calculator.
Good Lord.
And I said, all I want is a $5 note, please. And she pulled out a card. And I just thought, well, this is really indicative of how things have changed. And I'm not saying it's better or worse or anything like that. It's just that when I add up, I don't use my calculator. I still do it on a piece of paper and a pencil or in my head.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's how we do it, so we make it.
But I'm sure my grandparents were exactly the same. I'm sure they shook their heads over my mother and her brothers and sisters in their bobby socks in 1940s I'm sure. And 34,
Yeah, yeah, we see that. I think that's just the way it goes,
I remember my grandmother when we came home from a trip once. She said, I can't wait to get inside and take my corset off and have a good old scratch. And I thought, that's a real sign of how different life is.
Well, I always like to get in and get a good scratch myself.
Yeah. Well, some things never change and some things never stay the same, I guess.
Well, Garrick, we are out of time, but it's been a great show. And of course, it's been great. Now the book you have to go out and get is called Servants of the Crown, and it's The Turkish Pretender. So, and the author has been a guest, Garrick Jones. Thank you for being here.
It's been my pleasure, guys. I have really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Same here. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.